You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. And our guest on this hour of the Made of Clay Report is Barbara Berry. Welcome, Barbara.
Thank you.
It's good to have you here this morning. So the way we start the show and is to ask you to just answer the question or address the question, who are you? What are the qualities that you aspire to or that you have? What are the labels you wear? What is the picture that you want to start the conversation with?
Well, right now, I guess, first of all, I would see myself as an older woman. I'm just entered my 80th year, who has had a very rich and wonderful life. And I'm at the point where I'm sort of assessing what my life has been, and mm-hmm. and it has brought me a lot of pleasure. And the other part of that is that I have also reached the point where I kind of savor life a lot more than I did when I was younger and was rushing around doing things.
Right, you didn't know what you were moving through right. So quickly and not paying attention to.
Right.
Wow.
The qualities that other people identify in me is that I'm a good listener. I think that's partly because I've always been very curious about people and what makes them tick.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's something I enjoy doing is listening to other people and trying to figure out what makes them the way they are.
Yeah.
And I love to laugh. I love to be with funny people.
Uh-huh.
I'm not particularly witty myself, but every once in a while I come out with a good one.
I would imagine that you are capable of rather wry humor.
Yeah, I suppose. But I really enjoy laughing, and I came from a family where there was a lot of laughter, so that's important to my
yes.
well-being.
Yeah.
I like to think that I'm kind to other people, and I think for the most part I am. You know, my dark side is that I have difficulties. I have high expectations of myself, and sometimes I'm pretty hard on myself.
Right. And so you beat yourself up more than you will at other people.
Than I would, yeah, it was necessary. Though that has lessened over the years.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I don't do it as much as I used to.
Yeah.
And the other thing is that I'm not very quick to respond always to, I don't think quickly. So that's always been a sore point for me. You know, when I want to put my thoughts in order, I can do it really well if I have time, but
right.
I don't do it right. You know, some people seem to be able to do it really quickly, and I can't.
Right, and it makes me wonder, do you process reality around you less in an intellectual form and more in an emotional form?
Yeah, I do it more.
Possibly more physically even.
Yeah.
And so then the words would come harder, and it
yeah.
would take time because you think with your emotions and not with your words.
Right.
Yeah.
That's interesting. I never thought of that.
And it may be, you may walk out of the show and say he's totally off base, but I notice things like that in
yeah.
people, and we'll come back to that later in the
okay.
show. You brought some music with you, and you wanted to start today with one of the brightest, most optimistic pieces in the Western canon. And we're going to start with Ode to Joy.
Okay.
This is the Made of Clay Report, and our guest on this hour is Barbara Berry. So, Barbara, I'd like, now that in your 80th year, mm-hmm. you reflecting back on your life, what do you see are one or two or three or four of the experiences that helped to shape the problem that you would gnaw on for much of your life, mm-hmm. or the joy that you, or the relief that you, or the satisfaction that you would so deeply know? I want to kind of try to go at it both ways if we can.
Well, I think a lot of what I am, certainly as with most people, was formed in my childhood, and I grew up in a family. My parents did not have much money at all, but they somehow managed to find rent a house on a farm where we lived for most of my growing up period, and it was the most wonderful place.
Where was that farm?
In Lancaster, Pennsylvania.
Okay.
And it was a working farm, and there were just, you know, it had everything. It had apple trees to climb. It had creeks to muddy around in. It was very beautiful. Lancaster is a really beautiful area.
Yes.
And I was very, that sense of nature and the beauty of nature really was instilled in me at that point. My parents were also very, you know, both of them were German heritage, and they had very strong expectations of me, and which I had to let go of a little bit.
Right.
That was hard, right? Yeah. That was the hard part sometimes. But I certainly, you know, learned from them to be honest, to be straightforward about things, to work hard, to do all those things that helped mm-hmm. make my life good. I also learned to be pretty adventuresome. After all, my father left his homeland. He came mm-hmm. over here. He had nobody here. he started a new life. And that was sort of an inspiration for me to do what I wanted to do, too.
Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So,
you also described the farm. And to me, being able to roll out into the rolling hills and to be able to explore without having to get permission from anybody, that also is an adventure that we often don't get to experience.
It was a safe place. It really was. Yeah, it was good. In some ways, we tried to recreate that for our children.
Uh-huh.
And I think they enjoyed that, too, here.
I'm sorry, and I cut you off. The mid-sentence.
I think they enjoyed that part of the life too.
But you were moving on to something else about your
My parents were very. They really wanted us to have a religious education, and so therefore we were sent to Sunday school. Neither of my parents went to church, but they sent us, and I went to a great church which I really liked. Where they have lots of choirs and it was good youth groups and that kind of thing. But at the end, in my high school years, I became president of the youth group, and we planned this program where we would talk to people from other churches and find out what they believed and, you know, to discuss the differences in our beliefs and so on. Well, we set it all up, and the minister got very angry about it. And basically, the first person who came was a Unitarian, and of course that was anathema.
That was hard. And was this a Catholic or a Lutheran church you were?
It was a Presbyterian.
Presbyterian church. Okay.
And so he sent people to the meeting who really ridiculed this person when they came to talk, and made them very uncomfortable, and me very uncomfortable since I had invited them. And that was a real critical thing for me. I went away to college, I left that church, and I never went back.
Uh-huh.
And it took me a while of searching to figure out where I wanted to be after that. So that also was kind of a critical thing. Leaving,
and
I miss some of the things from that
mm-hmm,
church.
Mm-hmm. But you also grew up, and you were the second generation of drop them off at church for Sunday school, but yeah. we don't attend. That actually began around 1900
right.
or so, and then it became more common among more educated or more affluent people mm-hmm. as the 20th century wore on. You were also a generation that grew up when belief meant intellectual proposition, not beloved, which is the root of the word. So when you ask somebody what they believe, historically it would have been, what do you love?
Mm-hmm.
What do you hold because their truth is somehow of compelling interest to you?
Right.
But it had become more a matter of propaganda and ideology as belief, which dogs us to this day.
Oh yes, especially now.
But you moved out and you didn't look back.
Yeah.
And you were starting to say that there's something that you miss.
Yeah, I do. I miss the music. I miss the especially the music, I think, and the Sunday school. They were very, very, very good about having very imaginative Sunday schools,
mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm.
good teachers and sand tables where you saw all the, you know, the things
right.
that you could imagine the Holy Land and that kind of thing. And I do miss that. I think that's too bad we don't have that in other places too.
Mm-hmm. So where did you go from there?
Well, I went to college, and then when I came home, I was from college, I was one of those people who had no idea what I was going to do next.
Yes.
But it wasn't hard to find a job, so I did. And then I decided I really wanted some more adventure. So I had begun to go to a Quaker meeting, mm-hmm. and I was interested in the American Friends Service Committee. So I went off and worked with the American Friends Service Committee in Mexico.
Uh-huh.
Which was really a change for me. I mean, I don't know what I was expecting, but I wasn't expecting what happened. I didn't expect to move into a culture. I mean, I guess naively, I really thought, well, this would be sort of the same as...
People are people, it's just a different language,
that's
right?
That's right, right. But it was a different way of thinking. It was a different, you know, it was people lived differently. It was...
The music's different.
Oh, the music's wonderful. Talk about the music. The music's wonderful. I love it to this day. but
it shocked you.
It shocked me, and I fell in love with the place. Mm-hmm. I just really did. I also fell in love.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
So, because my husband was working there. He was doing his alternative service there for the service, so he didn't have to serve in the Army.
Right.
And...
This has been in the mid to late 50s.
Yeah, it was the early 60s.
Early 60s, yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah.
So then I went to Costa Rica because I met some people who, Quakers, who had gone down to Costa Rica to live in a country where they didn't have to pay war tax.
Aha. Uh-huh.
So I went and taught school for a year. And my husband came down. He was traveling through Central America, and he came down there. And after we came home, about 7 months after we came home, we got married.
Uh-huh, uh-huh. Neat.
So that's a lovely... we've been together ever since.
and he was a lifelong Quaker? He is a lifelong Quaker?
Yes, yeah. Well, his parents, yes, he was. His parents were Quakers.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So what about the next phases? How have things? I mean, you're looking back, and you're slowing down. What do you know now that might have made things different for you in those early years, or your reactions to things a little different in those early years?
One of the things that I it's sort of what you know. If you ask the question of how. Out of that sort of comes, how have I changed?
Right, how have you changed?
Yeah. I think the thing that happened for me, one of the things that I grew up with was a great deal of judgment. Excuse me.
Yes.
I'm sorry.
Do you need a tissue? Because I can get you.
I have a cough drop.
I see. Okay.
So I not only judgment of myself, but also judgment of the way other people acted and so on. Mm-hmm. And I noticed that slowly but surely I've let go of that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I don't have a lot of expectations of people. I sort of kind of accept them the way they are.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how that happened. I was thinking about it. There was no, you know, meeting on the road to Damascus or anything like that.
It was
just a slow, gradual thing where I realized that if I'm going to be curious about people and interested in what they, how they perceive the world, then I just need to let that go.
Right, right. For me, I grew up in a similar German-influenced, kind of really smart and confusing judgmental with a good power of observation and judgment in that sense. And I can in reactive moments I can fall right back into that judgmentalism, but my life has been more accepting that you need a sharp eye to see what really is there, and sometimes it comes with the dark side of judgmentalism until you learn how to let it go.
Yeah.
And people's what people live towards on their own is equal to what I might aspire to for them, mm-hmm. and I need to just wait and see.
The other side of that is for myself, my own judgment.
Sure.
I judged myself a lot, and I worried a lot about what other people thought of me.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that sort of goes together.
Yes, the two, and the two go very well together.
And I've let go of that too. You know, as you get older, actually, you know, it just doesn't matter as much.
Well, it doesn't matter, but also you become a comic figure in your own life.
That's true.
Because you can see the silliness of yourself
and
enjoy it,
yeah.
Which is, you know, when I was 20, God forbid, I could not have that kind of levity,
that's right.
You know. Yeah,
and actually, I kind of enjoy that part of the work, and my husband and I do too. You know, things that we used to fight over when we were younger, we just don't. I mean, it becomes we laugh about it.
Right, and you've created a space where probably you can both get what you need, and it's probably different than what you thought it was.
That's right.
Well, so what should we go to musically next? Of the things that you sent to me, what should we listen to musically?
How about Homegrown Tomatoes? That's
okay. Yeah, yeah. And this is a John Denver tune, Homegrown Tomatoes. And our guest on this hour of the Made of Clay Report is Barbara Berry.
Ain't nothing in the world that I like better than bacon and lettuce and homegrown tomatoes. Up in the morning and out in the garden, get your ripe ones, don't get a hard one. Plant them in the spring, eat them in the summer. All winter without them's a culinary bummer. I forgot all about the sweating and the digging. Every time I go out and pick me a biggin. Homegrown tomatoes, what'd life be without homegrown tomatoes? Only two things that money can't buy, and that's true love and homegrown tomatoes. Homegrown tomato won't cure. Put them in a salad, put them in a stew. You can make your own very own tomato juice. You can eat them with eggs and eat them with gravy. You can eat them with beans, pinto or navy. Put them on the side, put them in the middle. A homegrown tomato on a hot cake griddle. Homegrown tomatoes, what'd life be without homegrown tomatoes? Only two things that money can't buy, and that's true love and homegrown tomatoes. Life I lead, you could call me Johnny Tomato Seed, cause I know what this country needs, it's homegrown tomato in every yard you see. When I die, don't bury me in a box in a cold dark cemetery. Out in the garden would be much better, cause I could be a pushing up a homegrown tomatoes. Homegrown tomatoes, homegrown tomatoes. What a life be without homegrown tomatoes. There's only two things that money can't buy, and that's true love. Homegrown tomatoes, homegrown tomatoes. What a life be without homegrown tomatoes. There's only two things that money can't buy, and that's true love. Homegrown tomatoes.
That was John Denver and Homegrown Tomatoes, and there are only two things that money can't buy: true love and homegrown tomatoes. And we're gonna let the homegrown tomatoes stay with John Denver for a minute here, but we're gonna talk a little bit about true love.
True love.
And what I'd like to hear your thoughts on is, how has being married for 52 years made you aware that you maybe weren't the person you thought you were at the beginning of that time, or made you aware of things you could be that you didn't know you could be in the beginning? How has marriage changed you?
Well, I think the wonderful thing, the thing that's really been good for me in our marriage is that Frank never... He always thought I could do whatever I wanted, whatever I could do, you know. Mm-hmm. And he always supported me in everything that I wanted to do. And he, there was never, we got married before the feminist revolution,
sure.
The second feminist wave. And so, I think my mother was a pretty obedient wife, mostly. She also had a hot temper, so sometimes that didn't work.
Obedience with a short fuse.
That's right. So I would always ask him, well, what, you know, can I do this or can I do that? And it was a puzzling question to him.
Why are you asking me, woman?
Right. Yeah. What do you want to do? And I really like that. You know, I thought, yeah, that's right. And that changed me. I didn't have to be that kind of person anymore where I was beholden to somebody else.
He actually let you out of the thumb of judgment.
Yeah.
Yeah, not your judgment, but your expectation of judgment from others.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow.
So that was really a gift from him.
Uh-huh.
And I think for him, I gave him sort of the gift of being a person who really enjoyed being with people and, you know, entertaining and kind of just enjoying being with other people, which he's a little more reserved and doesn't
a little
do that,
shy or introverted.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And you're more the extrovert.
And so that was, I think, a gift for him.
Mm-hmm.
And I see that as what we did for each other. We gave each other the gifts of being our best selves.
Right, right.
When
but
we
also,
got,
and this comes back to your earlier comment about when you tried to organize the different beliefs.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he believed in you in the sense that he loved you.
Yeah.
You know, and stood
yeah, he
by
really,
your
he's
expectation.
Always, he's really,
yeah.
Even sometimes when I did things that he wasn't, he said, oh, no, you can't do that. You know, or you
but
can
you
do
still
it.
Did it, and he still went.
Yeah, right, right. Why do you want to do that? Not you can't do it, but why do you want to do that?
Yeah, yeah, no, but I mean, and sometimes you can't, you know, is said with the tone as, why in God's
right.
earth would you want to do this?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
In fact, it was interesting. I went over to Seneca Lake and got arrested at Crestwood. And this was just, not 2 years,
just,
two years ago. And so, then he said to me, what on earth do you want to do? You're too old. You can't do that anymore.
Why are you going off and getting arrested?
Do that. But he went with me.
Uh-huh.
He waited while I, you know, through the whole process, and he supported me.
Right, right, right.
So.
And you have, in a sense, you describe what I would call basking in the glow of a long-lasting love.
Yeah.
Where you've been able to look after and look to each other's well-being, even if you don't have to agree on what tangent you run off on.
Right.
In that experience, what did you? What got drawn out of you that you don't think you would have known had you been not been loved so long and so well?
A real acceptance of myself.
Okay.
And that is a real precious thing. You know, I'm so glad that he gave that to me or nurtured that in me.
Yeah.
He really always. It just seemed that, you know, there wasn't anything. He would, you know, we had our differences in fights and so on, but there wasn't anything really basic that I would do that he couldn't support and love in me.
Right.
And that's been a real gift for me.
Yeah. And what I want to do is just note that your spouse can offer you acceptance, but until you accept yourself, then the circle's not complete. But once the circle's complete, how did that change your ability to be a mother, a coworker, a cause, you know, pursuer? How has that made a difference in your life?
Well, it allowed me to be freer to do the things that I maybe thought I ought to do, but was kind of scared.
Right. So it reduced your fear.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And it made me less. It changed some of my expectations of myself, in that I sort of learned, well, there are certain things that I can do well, and I can pursue those.
Mm-hmm.
There are things that other people do well that I can't do well, right. And I can accept that. And that was hard for me. I used to believe, well, I should be able to do everything, you know. But that isn't true now. I see.
Loving yourself is partly loving your limitations and accepting them.
Right. So I guess those were the things that were.
Yeah.
That were important in that.
Did it affect the way you parented individually and as a couple?
Oh, yeah, I really think a lot.
And when you look back at what your experience, I mean, and our kids have their own experiences, which may be very different than our intent, or even the same thing experienced in a different way. But how do you feel like the quality of your marriage affected your ability to parent?
Well, it's interesting. Frank and I are both oldest children in the family.
So you were both in charge on
yes,
some level.
Yes, we were. We also had very, you know, our parents had put high expectations on us as a result of that. And I think that we did the same thing. We followed that same pattern.
So you repeated it a bit.
Our oldest child. We were kind of tough on her.
Right.
Because we expected this and we expected that. And, you know, she was kind of floundering sometimes about knowing she wanted to be what we wanted her to be, you know.
But it was a struggle.
But it was hard.
And it was your struggle more than in some
than
sense
hers. Yes, yeah. Right.
When did you realize that?
Oh, about the third child.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And the second, our second daughter was very, she was very outrageous in a sense. I mean, she's very funny and she. She just did what she wanted
she
to do.
She defied the dickens out of you.
and so by the time we got to the third, it was just like, oh, well, this is a piece of cake and we accept anything she does. So I think, you know, our way of being with our children got softer and softer and softer. And the other thing that happened was Frank and initially really saw raising the children as my job.
Uh-huh.
So by the time we got to the third child, he decided, no, that was really nice to be a parent. So there was a lot more involvement. And
right.
That was really good, too.
Right. And you use the term, we got softer.
Yeah.
What do you mean, what in practical terms, what do you mean by that?
Well, we were always pretty permissive. My parents would say permissive.
You were generous.
Yeah.
And accommodating.
We didn't come down hard, really hard on them about a lot of things. And we set some limits, but they were different, for instance.
And
they
broad limits.
But as we were less critical. It wasn't so much that our style of setting limits and, you know, being loving parents and that kind of thing changed. It's just that we were less critical of the children.
Right. You had allowed your critical eye to see things without reacting to them.
And that, I think, made a big difference in our younger two children. Mm-hmm. So.
Neat. How many children do you have overall?
Three.
Okay.
Yeah. Three girls.
Wow.
And we have five grandchildren. So.
Yes.
We're grandparents too.
Yes. You have had a rich life, and you leave a rich human legacy.
Yeah.
But I imagine also. As your children left, and as you faced each other as a couple in the empty nest, and I'm assuming that did happen. You describe your husband as becoming more curious about and interested in being a father, an active father. How did other things change in your relationship when the kids were grown?
Well, actually, that was a very good time for us. I mean, we missed the
for
kids.
Many people, that's the best time.
Yeah. We really... really sort of enjoyed each other more than we did initially in our marriage, actually. Because when we first were married, I think each of us had really weird expectations of what marriage was going to be, you know.
And so, what do you remember them as being?
Well, from my point of view, for Frank, I think it was that he was essentially going to live as a single man, but it just happened to have a wife.
Happened. There'll just be somebody he stays with.
That's right. But for me, it was, he will understand everything that I am thinking. I don't even have to tell him.
He'll read your mind.
He'll read my mind.
Yes.
Well, that had to change. That had to change a lot. And
you were both the oldest children.
Right. So by the time we, had raised our children, and those things were gone.
Right.
But I still find myself, every once in a while I think to myself, what is really going on in his mind? what was he really thinking?
Once
we ask each other.
I have a friend who is in her early 90s, and she's been married for over 65 years. Mm-hmm. And she said, you know, one of the things that keeps my marriage alive is, you know, he still does things that I don't understand.
Yeah, right.
And I would never predict that coming out of his mouth. And it just kind of keeps...
It keeps the fire going.
Exactly.
But I think the unexpected it can be a real delight in a relationship, you know.
Yep.
And if it's the same old, then it's kind of boring after a while.
Right, and I think, you know, as you were kind of implying, in the beginning, you want to think you know how it can go, but you also want to have that blown out of the water to be surprised by something that's more and different than what you would have anticipated. The temptation is to think you know it, or to think that you're comfortable in it, and then you want to be surprised by your loved one, and not to seek that surprise somewhere else in your life.
Yeah.
Because that keeps your marriage close.
Yeah. And exciting.
Yeah.
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 Exciting.
Yeah. Keeps it with fireworks.
Right.
So I'm going to do the station ID, and you think about what music we play next.
Okay.
You're listening to WRFI Watkins Glen, Ithaca. This is the Made of Clay Report. And our guest on this hour is Barbara Berry.
Let's do City of New Orleans.
Okay. And we're going to play Arlo Guthrie's recording of City of New Orleans.
Riding on the City of New Orleans, Illinois Central,
Monday morning rail. 15 cars and 15 restless riders. 3 conductors, 25 sacks of mail. All along the southbound Odyssey, the train pulls out at Kankakee and rolls along past houses, farms, and fields. Passing trains that have no name, and freight yards full of old black men, and the graveyards of the rusted automobiles. Good morning, America. Don't you know me? I'm your native son. I'm the train they call the city of New Orleans. I'll be gone 500 miles when the day is done.
Dealing card games with the old man in the club car. Penny a point, ain't no one keeping score. Pass the paper bag that holds the bottle. Feel the wheels rumbling neath the floor. And the sons of Pullman porters and the sons of engineers write their father's magic carpets made of steel. Mothers with their babes asleep, rocking to the gentle beat, and the rhythm of the rails is all they feel. Good morning, America, how are you? Said, don't you know me? I'm your native son. I'm the train they call the city of New Orleans. I'll be gone 500 miles when the day is done.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca. This is the Made of Clay Report, and our guest on this hour is Barbara Berry. And that was Arlo Guthrie's City of New Orleans. So, Barbara, you said there are some special stories about trains in your life.
Yes. It's funny, the first story is kind of amusing because we were in Mexico and Frank asked me to go over to get some ice cream at Sanborn. So this is this sort of fancy place in Mexico City. And we were talking and I told him that we were going to go to Oaxaca for Christmas. And he said, oh yeah, I've been down there. He said, I had something. I said, well, why did you go to Oaxaca? And he said, got this funny look on his face. And all I could think of was, darn it, he's got a girlfriend down there.
Well, you're going to lose him as fast as you found him.
That's right. Well, it turned out it was a steam engine. It was a train.
It was a special train. It was back in the day.
So, and I was so relieved.
That he was in love with the steam engine.
That's right. But still, you know, it never hit me how much it really meant to him until we were married for a while.
Uh-huh.
And then we really, you know, I realized that it's just often he thinks of things in terms of the images of trains. You know,
sure.
That's the way he sort of processes things. And so I just had to get used to that. I mean, I never felt a competition with it.
No.
Interestingly enough, because I guess you could, you know. I think there were other people that we met where the wives really felt, you know.
Like the trains were interfering with their relationship.
Yeah, they're much more important. But I didn't ever feel that.
You described something that was explained to me in junior high or high school by a friend of mine who loved trains, train tracks, maps.
Mm-hmm.
His mind worked in that way, or in those ways. And it helped me to kind of see people need a structure for experiencing reality.
Mm-hmm.
And when you accept that, and you accept that they love their their way of experiencing it, then you can sometimes talk the same language.
Yeah.
How did you have to change the way, how did you need to address him to speak into his railroad self? Or was it, or did it make a difference?
Yeah, I don't think it made a difference.
You just understood. I just understood that.
Yeah. I mean, it took a while for me to understand it because I had to, excuse me, I'm sorry.
Yep.
Again.
Yep.
I had to realize that when, you know, I'd ask him, well, what are you thinking about? That always came out in that,
sure,
that form. But now I do, and I kind of, you know, I just sort of accept that's the way it is.
Yeah, yeah, it's the...
And it's not even that onerous.
Right.
It isn't onerous.
No, I mean, we all have to have a way of understanding and framing.
Yeah.
And it's easier if we accept it.
Yeah, for me, I tend to frame things psychologically.
Mm-hmm.
And he accepts that of me.
Yeah.
So...
Yep, I have a lot of respect for your being able to do that. I want to change gears just a little bit. As you are becoming more kind and more experiencing the fruits of awareness with less judgment, what are your tasks in these last years of your life? What are the things that keep you focused? What are the things that capture your attention and keep you engaged?
Well, I've always been active in the community in terms of, you know, issues of social justice.
Sure. So, I mean, you're well known for that.
So that certainly is something that I would continue and feel is very much a part of.
Mm-hmm. Do you engage it in a slightly different way now, though?
Yeah, well, what's happening is that my energy is waning.
Mm-hmm.
So I've had to let go of being really active in a lot of things. I still, you know, have spurts like going to Crestwood and getting retro.
Right, right.
You know, that's it. But generally, I have had to draw back. So instead of... the activism, what I find myself happening, and I don't know why this happened, is that I view people and I treat people and I approach people with a great deal of tenderness, that I feel that that's really important. In this world, we are struggling so hard with all the terrible pressures that there are and all of the things that we hear all the time and all the things that we're afraid of. And I just feel that everyone needs a lot of tenderness, and that is where, and it is just comes. It's not something that I said, okay, today I'm going to start being tender, you know.
Right, right.
But it just comes. I tend to see people that way. I tend to look at them much more tenderly and treat them much more tenderly.
I'm going to play dumb here, and it's not playing dumb because I am dumb on this. When you see them with tenderness, how is it that you see them differently now than you did before?
Yeah. Well, I think before it was really, I was curious. And
you were kind of invasive in your curiosity.
Yeah. And I wasn't necessarily that empathetic always.
Right. You just wanted to know him.
Yeah, I just wanted to know.
You scored another person.
Yeah.
I mean, in a crass sort of way. Yeah.
But now, I really, it's almost as if I feel the heart of the person.
Yeah.
And that's different.
Yeah.
And it's a good thing. For me, it nurtures me to be able to feel the heart of someone else, in a sense.
Right, right. And to realize that to some extent that is a projection, but that's what you're striving for.
Yeah.
Is so that, and you can see the evidence in the way they smile or wince or express fear or hope, mm-hmm, that you have, in a certain sense, gotten a feel for their heart.
Yeah, yeah.
And their courage.
Yeah, I really admire people's bravery. I really do. I think people... struggle very hard with a lot of difficult things, mm-hmm. and then they that we don't always recognize necessarily. I didn't always recognize how hard it was.
Right. And when we live in a culture that doesn't encourage direct, honest conversation,
mm-hmm.
we know we become dumber.
Yeah.
Because of it. We dumb down our communities. What you describe in terms of being able to be empathetic and to look into the other person with a kind of a kindness and acceptance and empathy, and I'm blocking on the word that you used for some reason.
It's tenderness.
Tenderness, that's yes. To me, that sounds very close to the Quaker practice of holding things in the light.
Yeah, I think my Quaker experience has really nurtured that in me. And that's probably a lot of why it came about, you know, is that using the, or being a part of a meeting where everyone is focused on trying to experience the light has really helped me,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
you know, experience it myself.
And not long ago, I was part of a worship service at the Quaker
meeting. Thanksgiving,
house.
Yeah.
And what is so impressive to me is to have three or four people assigned during that service to hold that service in the light so that they will be a calm presence seeking that the service can be all that is possible for mm-hmm. those gathered there, that it will maintain its wholeness and integrity and deepen in whatever ways, even alarming ways, for people mm-hmm. to have a more profound experience of what is and what can be
right.
possible. That's very powerful. I think in activism, and it's helpful to have people who are on the periphery, perhaps like your husband when you were being arrested, who can be that presence while somebody else is taking action.
Yeah, I do. I think so, too.
And we've seen it also in work where people go and work on the homes of somebody who needs repairs or mm-hmm. whatever, who can't afford it or do it themselves. One of the people on the job is assigned to just sit and visit with the person who's mm-hmm. receiving the gift of labor of others so that can be held in the spirit that it's intended, which is one of a whole relationship and not just fixing somebody's
yeah,
problem.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
That's good.
I want to go to the question that I generally end the show with in our last, you know, 5 to 10 minutes here. What do you do on a daily basis, weekly, monthly, yearly, to restore yourself emotionally, physically, and intellectually? And when do you need to do something? We're going to play with these kind of concepts for the next few minutes.
Well, I read a lot, so mm-hmm. I do.
What sorts of things do you read?
Well, I really keep up on the news. I mm-hmm. read the New Yorker. I read articles, you know, about what's going on in the world. I also have been reading more on getting older and what are the gifts of getting older. The time that we have to reflect, you know, the ability to look at the world in a more long-term view, you mm-hmm. know. Those kinds of things that are things that I am struggling with now. Not struggling, but really, yeah, struggling, I guess, is a good word to say.
You're wrestling or engaging with them.
Engaging, yeah. It's a good way to put it.
And the wrestling imagery or the engaged imagery is there's a level of physicality in how you know or how you learn.
Mm-hmm.
That's, you know.
I'm part of my struggle now is that I've gotten a diagnosis of a disease that has no cure.
Mm-hmm.
And recently, I was in the hospital and now I'm on dialysis.
Uh-huh.
Which I will be on for the rest of my life. And that has been a big change, has been a big change in our life. Because, you know, you have to go 3 times a week and you have to go someplace else and get it. And it's just
it's laborious, yeah, and it takes a few hours to go through the dialysis process, and it ties up almost of a day.
Right. So all the things that I used to do, you know, to get around the community and do what I needed to do and so on, have been really curtailed.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm dealing with that. That's been my most recent struggle, and actually it's only the last few weeks that it's happened.
Mm-hmm.
And But what I find at first I would, you know, I was just so mad about it, and I hated it.
Right. I don't want to give it up.
Yeah,
I don't want to have to do this.
But now it's beginning to smooth out, you know, and it's not that I like it. It's not that I enjoy going to dialysis or anything like that. But I feel a little more acceptance of it than I did before.
Right.
And I see also, part of it is that I'm able to see beyond what just the dialysis and realize that there are things in my life that I still enjoy and can still do and still,
right.
I can still work around.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So that's been...
And you you're not living the life that you lived even 3 months ago.
Yeah, no.
Because it's changed.
Yeah.
And there's a certain kind of grief that comes with that and anger. I mean, when the change happens, it's usually anger. And then at some, but have you discovered that there were some things where the running wasn't as important as you thought it was?
Oh, yes. Yeah. That's the other thing that's happened is that I'm home more.
Mm-hmm.
I can be more reflective. Can put things in order that I had just kind of left.
Right,
big mess, actually. So this is, that's been very good for me to do. And it's been kind of enjoyable with my kids, too, because, we can talk about these, for instance, we found a whole batch of letters that Frank and I wrote to each other while we were
uh-huh.
We were engaged, and the kids were really interested in reading that and seeing what we were like, and so on. And we can engage that way with them, which is fun.
That's really beautiful.
Yeah.
And in this space where what I'm gonna use a word where wholeness matters more than movement.
Mm-hmm.
A sense of bringing things each step to completion, you know, or at least let's end this verse and we'll start the next verse.
Yeah,
you know, and kind of you move in a intentional sort of way. What are the things that you see that you would like to do if you could get around to, if you have the time? Are there things that you're more carefully addressing now?
Well, one of the things that I had thought about was trying to write a little bit of my life, so you know, mm-hmm. just for my children,
sure,
and my grandchildren. I haven't even started that idea, so I mean, I haven't even started to do it. That's one possibility. I think there's not a lot at this point.
Right,
it's more that I just want to be present. I want to be with people and be present with people.
Yeah. No sense of regrets or things you need to rush to complete.
Yeah, no.
Or at least not an overpowering sense of anything.
No,
of that.
Not really.
Yeah, yeah.
My anxiety, I think a lot about death.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
But my anxiety about it is not what's going to happen or what I've not done.
Right.
It's mainly separation anxiety.
Right.
You know, leaving what I love.
Right.
That's the real...
The process and the act of letting go or being taken away.
Yeah.
Yeah. Of not, yeah. It makes sense.
Yeah.
It makes sense. It sounds, I mean, living with kindness, living purposefully, living with compassion,
mm-hmm.
the fullness of your days. it's a beautiful gift that you can not just give yourself, but you can give everybody around you. And then when you hit bumps, because there are bumps, I'm sure, with things that don't go right with dialysis, or they don't go right with kids or grandkids or whatever, yeah. Or your husband, then you can try to meet it with kindness. And at the very least, there's a beauty to what you're doing.
That's what I feel that not so much seeing the beauty from the outside, but
you're living it.
Yeah, there's a peacefulness to it, a depth that I appreciate, and, you know, that I have, that I've been given, you know.
And you are giving it to others. Barbara, it has been wonderful to get to know you.
Well, thanks. I really have enjoyed this. And it was not as hard as I thought it was going to be.
Good. It rarely is. It rarely is for people. You wanted to end with a song, I'll Fly Away?
That's right.
And I found a live version from Emmylou Harris.
Oh, wonderful.
Would you like to say something about it before I play it?
Well, that's, as I said, I do think about death. And this song sort of represents what my vision of it is.
Okie dokie.
That I'll fly away.
And we'll end with that.